walks like an animal, talks like an animal, must be an animal. Come hear the animals, talking animal, talking animal. Talks like an animal, must be an animal. Come hear the animals, talking animals, talking animal.
Good morning, this is Talking Animals. I'm Duncan Strauss, and my guest today is Al Cicery, founder and president of the American Eagle Foundation, a Tennessee-based organization dedicated to bald eagle rehabilitation, recovery, and breeding programs, and, well, looking after other birds of prey. As part of those efforts, Cicery trained Challenger, a rescued bald eagle who couldn't be released back into the wild, to perform free flight demonstrations during the Star-Spangled Banner, which this bird has done at World Series games, NFL Pro Bowls, and other major events. We'll find out about the beginnings of the American Eagle Foundation, the evolution of the organization, the Challenger story, and more when I speak with Al Cicery in a few moments here on Talking Animals. Also later in the show, I speak with Don Goldstein, our Greyhound correspondent, who's been helping us track the process by which Prop 67, the proposed constitutional amendment that if passed would end Greyhound racing in Florida, and will outline the key next step that you could help with. Also later is the prize for Name That Animal Tune. I'll offer a pair of tickets to The Wait, a tribute to the band, performing at the Capitol Theater on April 6th. Right now, though, let's get to Al with a reminder that I invite you to join the conversation by calling 813-239-9663, emailing dj@wmnf.org, or texting 813-433-0885. This is Al Cicery on Talking Animals. Good morning, Al.
Hey, good morning.
Thanks for joining us on Talking Animals. So, you know, I'm approaching my 15th year of doing this show, Al, and while I've spoken with countless people who very early in their lives felt a powerful connection with a cat or a dog, and at some point thereafter found themselves working on behalf of cats or dogs or just animal welfare generally, I'm pretty sure you're the first person I've spoken to who felt that kind of kinship with an eagle and devoted his life since then to helping eagles and other birds of prey. So take me back, if you would, to those earliest days. What spoke to you about these birds in the very beginning?
Well, it was over 30 years ago that I founded the American Eagle Foundation off my kitchen table. I was working in the entertainment business in Nashville, TV shows and films and such. I have a degree in motion picture production. But anyways, going back to a child, I loved animals. I had all kinds of animals of menagerie in my backyard that I cared for daily and just couldn't get enough of them, and always wanted to be a veterinarian all my life, dreamed to be a veterinarian. But I ended up changing that after getting out of the military, and I was trying to decide what to do, and I went to film school as a result. But then when I got out, I saw an AP photograph in the Tennessean in Nashville, the newspaper, that showed 24 eagles that had been shot by poachers in a Dakota, and it just knocked me over, like seeing 24 eagles laying side by side in an AP photograph. And I had to call my state wildlife agency right away, which I had never done before, and asked to talk to the guy that knew the most about eagles. Talked to a man named Bob Hatcher, who was conducting an eagle recovery program in Tennessee at the time. He became my mentor for years, helping me with anything I needed to get the foundation, operating in a way that was positive for eagles. And Bob was the non-game endangered species coordinator, and without me meeting him, I would not be doing what I'm doing today.
Boy, but it sure sounds like that photo hit you hard, and that you were immediately a man of action to say, okay, well, I'm outraged and upset by this. What can I do? A lot of people might feel that way upon seeing a photo like that, but wouldn't necessarily track down, in this case, Bob Hatcher, and set yourself on a path that would mean doing a world of good for all kinds of eagles and other birds of prey.
That's correct, and I just, you know, would go out to eagle releases with Bob and learn how they were recovering eagles, and then it was just a matter of just continually studying the subject, and not just studying it, but taking action every day to help eagles, trying to raise money to support state, federal, and private programs. And also, around that same time where I saw the AP photo, President George Bush Sr., who was only had one term that he served as president, he gave a State of the Union address where he talked to the public about points of light. It's never been mentioned before. And he said that the American people need to get involved in all areas of life to help, because the government could not do it all. And he suggested that people become points of light. When I heard that, it was right around the same time that I told Bob I'd start volunteering, and I knew right away that I wanted to be one of those. I wanted to be a point of light.
And by taking this action to help bald eagles and other birds of prey, that's how you could serve as that sort of point of light.
That's exactly right.
Yeah.
I've every waking hour that I wasn't somewhere else, I was trying to help eagles, and eventually I was able to hop trains all together and start to do full-time work for the American Eagle Foundation.
But early on, Al, I'd be curious if, I mean, you know, your sort of immediate passion and focus is pretty clear already, but in those early days when you would describe what you wanted to do and what you cared about and what you were trying to do in launching the foundation, I mean, did people kind of look at you like you were a bit like nuts in a way, or like, oh my God, I mean, this guy, you know, I admire his passion, but what's with the eagles? I mean, was there kind of a mixture of responses?
Yeah, I suppose there was. I mean, I was a guy who never really had a biology degree or, you know, had studied in any formal way to become involved in wildlife. But I had a world of experience as a child and as a young person caring for animals, you know, just out of my own, like you say, my passion. So my passion was driving me in the initial years of organizing the foundation, because there really wasn't any money and there wasn't really, you know, all the things that we really needed. It was a step-by-step process through a period of years before we, you know, we actually started to do some substantial things to help eagles. We did little things here and there in between my jobs and things like that. And so, you know, it's a process, and it's passion that gets you through it. It's your desire to do something more than you want to do anything else that gets you through and allows the foundation to eventually take off, for lack of a better word, and be able to, you know, gain some positive traction.
Yeah. Well, I'm not sure that's going to be the last bird pun or wordplay that we'll have today, because I may have one or two of my own. But yeah, I mean, back to the passion thing, which has already sort of become a theme here. I mean, I see it in so many things and talking to all kinds of people involved with animals and animal welfare. But like you say, I mean, you know, you hadn't studied it in any way. You didn't have any sort of animal degree, biology degree, anything. But when you felt that kind of passion, I mean, all those other things were incidental, really.
That's right. Yeah.
Yeah.
And also, my mother, from the earliest age that I can remember, she worked as a secretary to a veterinarian across the street from where we lived in upstate New York, and I had access to going over there all the time. I think that was also a sideline and inspiration of wanting to become a veterinarian, you know, as a young child, being with it.
Yeah, it sounds like animals, and whether caring for them as trying to become a vet or just generally, was always kind of hovering around, even when you were more in the film business or showbiz before you saw that AP photo. So let folks know, this is Talking Animals. I'm Duncan Strauss. If you just tune in, my guest is Al Cicery, founder of the American Eagle Foundation, a Tennessee-based organization dedicated to bald eagle rehabilitation, recovery, breeding programs, looking after other birds of prey, and more. If you'd like to ask Al a question or offer a comment, please call 813-239-9663, email dj@wmnf.org, or text 813-433-0885. So, leaving aside Challenger for now, of course we'll get to him in a moment, but what would you cite now, like you say, a better part of 30 years later, as the American Eagle Foundation's two or three most notable achievements over those years?
Well, you know, we're really involved in a lot of different facets, but primarily public education, like you said, rehabilitation of injured eagles and birds of prey, breeding of disabled eagles and releasing their young into the wild. Those are, you know, some key parts of our program. And so, you know, we've been able to release hundreds of birds of prey back into the wild over the years. You know, some obviously didn't make it because their injuries were so serious.
Sure.
And we've been able to take eagles that were permanently disabled and otherwise would not have a home and could not be released. And we paired them up, and we were able to hatch babies year after year and release them into the parts of Tennessee that where we're trying to recover them. Right now, for instance, I believe right now we've got 6 eagle eggs so far for the spring of this year, and we're getting an eagle out of Florida that was hatched at a center down there, and those will be released into the wild to help repopulate. Of course, you know, only less than 50% survived the first year, so, you know, a lot of birds have to be released to eventually recover a population, but the population nationwide has come a long way since the time I started, when there was only probably about 400 nesting pairs in the lower 48 states. We probably could estimate at least 15,000 pairs in the same territory today. And it's just not just my work, but it's other people, organizations, and corporations, and everyone who kind of pitched in and helped a little bit here and there to to recover eagles, you know. So it was a team effort of people who just love eagles.
Right, but it sounds like the thing that sort of drove you initially was that disturbing photo. And so early on, at least, was your focus really, hey, what can I do for bald eagles, or what can I do for bald eagle, the numbers, the population?
Yeah, it was a little of each, because early on in my passionate walk to helping eagles is, you know, I was helping the state release eagles into the wild that had been captive hatched in different parts of the country, and I was getting sponsors to fund those programs. We also, were able to rehabilitate in the early days as well, injured eagles and birds of prey, and put them back out. But it was just, like I say, it was a growing, gradual process of getting the necessary funding to do these things and to increase the size of our organization and the expertise of our employees and things of that nature. Today, public education is still a biggie. We have video cameras on two wild nests, one in Washington, D.C. at the National Arboretum, and we call the pair Mr. President, the First Lady, and then we have a nest in Northeast Florida called the Romeo and Juliet nest. So people are able to watch these nests day and night and see high-quality video images and sound and follow the entire nesting season if they so choose. So that's public education. That's reaching, actually, our camera in D.C. has reached well over 65 million people, 65 million views. So a lot of people are being educated. We even invite classrooms to come in with their teachers and watch it live, and our moderators on a chat will answer questions and educate, and we do that with the general public as well. We also have a thing called American Eagle Day that I established over 10 years ago. It's just on June 20th, 1782, the eagle was picked as the national symbol by the Second Continental Congress. So we picked that day to celebrate American Eagle Day. To date, I've got 49 governors who have declared it, and I've had both houses of Congress declare it with resolutions as well. And we're just trying now to make it a final push to get a president to get behind it. And so we can make it a permanent day for all of America that will reoccur. Every year. Right now, we have to go out to all the governors every year and all the Senate and the House and try to get, you know, the resolutions and the proclamations passed. But people are celebrating that around the country in schools and other places. And so it's a gradual process for that. But it's raising awareness about where the eagle once was. We almost lost it due to our own, you know, foolishness and neglect. And now it's come back to great numbers in the United States, although there still are challenges. And this is a day to recognize that, focus on that, so we don't forget.
Yeah. No, it sounds like, of course, I'm curious to know just who's been holding out there amongst the governors, but sounds like you got just about all of them.
Jerry Brown's the only one that we really haven't got. So.
Oh, really? That's interesting. Right. Wow. I wouldn't have guessed that. So a couple things about things you've mentioned here about some of the efforts. First of all, just to back up to the nest cam, in the last couple of days in preparing to speak with you, I've spent more than a little time on Romeo and Juliet in particular. It's addicting. I mean, you tune in, and because it's these are just live streams of these eagles, and then sometimes I would actually go back to doing something else on my computer, and then I'd hear a noise because I still left the camera on. I thought, well, what are they doing now? And next thing I know, I'm not getting my work done because I'm watching Romeo and or Juliet do whatever they're doing. And it's once you sort of get following them, it's pretty hard to shake it off.
Yeah, it is. It's very addicting, and you know, animal lovers from all walks of life and all ages are watching those cams day and night.
Yeah.
The Florida nest right now, we've got the youngsters that have already fledged, and they still return to the nest a little bit, but eventually here in the next couple of weeks, they'll probably leave, permanently, and then we'll move on to another. But the Washington, D.C. nest at the National Arboretum, they're about to lay their eggs. So people that have watched the Romeo and Juliet nest and the whole cycle, egg laying to raising their young, they can now jump over to the D.C. nest if they want to see another nest go through the process of raising a family.
At least when in sort of reading up about Romeo and Juliet, once I did get hooked. So maybe you could take a moment and just describe, just because it obviously has broader implications than just those two, how it works, like, because they come back, I don't know for how many years now, but they come back in a certain time of the year. They do their thing. They have their fledglings, I guess, and then hang for a certain bit. And then Romeo takes off somewhere. Juliet goes wherever she goes. And then they rendezvous. But how long has that been going on?
Oh, well, with them, it's probably been going on at least 8 years, 9 years maybe.
Yeah.
If I recall correctly. But Yeah, it's an amazing process because once they're done fledging their young and they might hang out till the end of April and then May, they just take off and they leave on a little vacation, not necessarily together. You know, some people feel that they do stay together, but there's other pairs that we found that actually split apart for a little rest period. And then they almost miraculously come back to the week in the same location to begin a new season. You know, it's like, that's the most amazing thing to me is their, not only their GPS systems, but to find where they, you know, once nested, but just the fact that the timing of it is so perfect. And so then they begin a whole new season again together. And this pair, the pair in Florida has already been through three hurricanes, you know. So they've survived three hurricanes with sticks being blown out of their nest and everything else where they had to kind of touch things up after the storm subsided.
And did I read correctly? I might have read too fast, but when I was reading about them and about their nest, and this may tie into sustaining themselves through those hurricanes, did I read correctly that the nest ultimately have a weight of like near a ton?
That the nest what?
That has a weight, like the overall nest or nest area has the weight of about a ton?
Well, they can. I mean, a lot of nests in Florida get fairly large, and they add to their nest year after year. They keep building it bigger and bigger, and there have been some that have weighed a ton or more.
Wow. And another thing that you'd mentioned earlier that I just wanted to circle back to is the thing which obviously has huge ramifications for the population is the thing you mentioned about in the first year, I guess less than 50% survive. What are the obstacles or challenges that they're facing in that first year to have such a low survival rate?
Well, obviously they have to learn to hunt. You know, they have to learn to hunt sufficiently, whether it's killing fresh fish, which is their main diet, or eating roadkill for a while. They still got to learn what to do and how to survive out there.
I see.
You know, they're facing predators all the time. When they're on the ground, I mean, it could be raccoons or fox and different things. So there's a big learning curve that happens, but it's an amazing thing how God has put this survival thing in the eagle, almost like they've planted movies of how to do things, like on YouTube or so in their own. But, you know, and it's just amazing to see the survivors come from very inexperienced beginnings and become birds that, you know, we see time after time, 5 years or 6 years down the road, because we have a marker on their wing and we can identify them, you know.
Yeah.
And people call us from different parts of the country and say, hey, do you know who G7 is or whatever? And, you know, we'll say, oh, yeah, that bird was released 6 years ago. You know, it's been all over the country.
Wow.
Or at least east of the Mississippi River, anyway. But, yeah, it's just it's an amazing animal. You know, in the sense of how they know where to be and when to be and how to survive basically on their own. I mean, eagles in the wild get some parent training, but now a lot of the eaglets that we release that have been hatched in captivity, you know, they get separated from the parents at about 8 weeks of age. We put them in a release tower that mimics a wild nest, overlooks a lake, and we feed them through a drawer system where they never know where they're getting their food from. These are the captive hatch ones I'm talking about. We've had so many of them just survive many, many years. And we hear from people and photographers around the country, you know, that take pictures of them.
Wow.
And it's very encouraging to know that they learned all this stuff on their own, or they were programmed to do it, you know, and that's what I guess genetics is all about. So the strong survive.
Yeah, it's really fascinating. But like you say, that learning curve sounds steep in that first mm-hmm. year or so.
Because if they don't learn very quickly, I mean, they've got to learn to survive within about 15 days. Because even if they're real fat in the nest, they can easily wear off all that fat in about 15 days by flying around and you know doing various activities in the wild. So they've got to learn to eat something. You
yeah.
know, either a roadkill or actually, you know, catch a fish on the shore or learn how to catch one. They've got to learn all that in a very short period of time.
Sounds like that clock is ticking loudly.
Mm-hmm.
And Al, is there any way to quantify how much the American Eagle Foundation's work is supported or applauded specifically because the bald eagle is such an important symbol? I mean, I'm sure some people would care, and they do, if a falcon's mm-hmm. injured or left orphaned or whatever, but I just somehow doubt it would generate the same kind of support or concern if the bird in question was indeed a bald eagle.
Yeah, I think being a bald eagle is always a big plus, you know, because it's the nation's symbol, and a lot of people revere it as that. But there's a lot of animal lovers who just love it for the beauty that you know, God made it to be. It's just an amazingly beautiful bird, very majestic, very powerful, and people just seemed to be mesmerized by and attracted to that type of an animal. And so it helps somewhat in funding the process because it does have that broad appeal. But, you know, there's a lot of charities out there today that are competing for dollars everywhere.
Sure.
And I mean, tens of thousands of them. And so, you know, it takes a lot of effort to keep things running, you know. And we've been blessed with various types of programs. Like, we have a state license plate, you know, that raises so much for us every year. I had went through the whole process of getting a gold, silver, and clad coin set approved by Congress, which took a lot of work to do. And then the U.S. Mint sold some coins, and we generated some money. And day-to-day, even Challenger, you know, he generates donations for us, and a lot of the bird shows that we take out to schools and other events with our birds that are permanently disabled and but are trained for educational purposes. There's various revenue streams, merchandise, you know, sponsorships, and you just have to every year go out for it, start all over again, basically, and just hope and pray that it all comes together.
This is Talking Animals. I'm Duncan Strauss. My guest is Al Cicerie, founder of the American Eagle Foundation, which is dedicated to the rehabilitation, recovery, and breeding of bald eagles and other birds of prey. He also trained Challenger, a rescued bald eagle, to fly around stadiums and during games and other major events during the singing of the national anthem. We'll hear more about that in a moment. We invite you to join the conversation, meanwhile, by calling 813-239-9663, emailing dj at wmnf.org, or texting 813-433-0885. So we're going to get at least one caller involved, and there's an email or two I want to get to, so let's get to our caller first. Hi, you're on Talking Animals with Al Cicerie.
Hi, is this me?
Yeah, please go ahead. It is you.
Oh, okay, thank you. Yeah, first of all, I'm so impressed with your guest, just almost by chance being inspired and taking action. I mean, it's just wonderful. But I have a couple questions. Originally, it was a photo about the poachers that that caught his attention. And I'm wondering, is that still the primary cause of the injury to the birds of prey that are being rehabbed, or are there other factors? That's one question. Mm-hmm. And my other one is, has he used any of his filmmaking skills or contacts to make maybe a documentary or in some other way make the situation public through his connection with filmmaking? And those are my questions.
Yeah. Well, both great questions, one of which I was going to get to later, but I have to say, I mean, maybe you should come sit next, stand next to me while I do that, because those are both very good questions. Al, how would you respond to each of those?
To the first question, yeah, many birds of prey are still shot, even though it's illegal, you know, including bald eagles. It still happens. And most of these situations are people who haven't been taught properly or who don't care. Same thing with people in other areas of life that do things that they're not supposed to do. You know, whether it be rob a bank or hurt somebody, you know, there's still those people out there. And so those things still happen. We have to rehabilitate many birds because of that. But they are also injured by traps, power lines, motor vehicles, poisons and contaminants, and other factors, you know, that are all mostly human-related, you know.
Yeah.
Even though they might not be purposefully done in all cases, you know, even traps, people are trapping animals legally, but then an eagle goes down and he grabs a piece of deer meat in it and he gets his leg trapped in it, you know, and, yeah, it could break it or injure it permanently for life. But anyways, so that's still, the guns are still part of it. It's not a, most people respect the laws. We're not anti-hunting necessarily, because people are doing things legally, obtaining permits legally. And but on the other side of the thing, you were asking about the, what was it again? I'm sorry.
Well, her second question was if you had drawn on your original filmmaking skills to combine that
Actually, yes, I have over the years. I've done my own PSAs, public service announcements that got, you know, aired on various things from country music television to, mm-hmm, Animal Planet, Animal Channels.
Yeah.
And so I've been able to produce those with country music stars, you know, speaking the appeal, you know, and then some beautiful footage and that kind of thing. I've done those. And I've also done a few things that you could say were mini documentaries, you know.
Great.
And there's been a number of those over the years. But it's something that I can't pursue full time, obviously, because I'm busy with so many other parts of the program. And maybe someday we'll do something bigger. But we get approached by a lot of people to do documentaries, too. So in the process of them producing their documentaries about what we do, my experience allows me to direct them into certain areas,
sure,
of gaining footage. And it ends up being something that's basically my program.
Yeah, because, I would think.
Because I just say, you'll want this and you'll want that. This looks real good on film. Things like that.
You're the secret director, as it turns out. But,
right,
yeah.
Right.
But now, speaking of country music stars, I believe there's a Dolly Parton element to the American Eagle Foundation story. And as if I don't already have a zillion reasons to adore Dolly, how does she figure in here?
Well, first off, let me say she is an amazing, wonderful person.
I'm sure.
For a lady that has as much recognition and stardom as she's achieved and experienced over the years, she's remained relatively beautifully grounded as a human being.
Yeah.
And so I appreciate her more than I could even describe. She's just a wonderful lady. But she's the obviously one of the owners of Dollywood, where we are headquartered in Pigeon Forge. And they became our main corporate sponsor back in 1991. I think we're in our 27th year at Dollywood.
Wow.
We have a Birds of Prey show called Wings of America on the park. We also have a large eagle exhibit called Eagle Mountain Sanctuary, which a lot of permanently disabled eagles can spend their lives either perching in trees and, you know, or even breeding on there. We've got a few nests on the park as well, a couple nests. So those are all supported by and funded by a large donation every year from the Dolly's company. Which is a great, great help to fund what we do. But 27 years has passed. We opened there in 1991, and it's just been a great relationship and good people to work for and work with, I mean, I should say. We're an independent charity that operates the sanctuary and the Birds of Prey show, but they are a corporate sponsor, basically.
Well, I'm going to go out on a limb here, Alan, say this partnership's going to work out pretty well, I think. You and Dolly.
I'd say it's...
So far, so good.
Yeah.
And what may be a classic instance of sort of saving the best for last, let's turn now to talking about Challenger. We've alluded to him a couple times, but if you don't mind recounting the story for, I'm sure, the umpteenth time, how did Challenger come to you and what happened after that?
Okay, well, first off, Challenger was blown out of a wild nest in Louisiana, and he wasn't physically injured, thank God, but... Some people found him the day after the storm subsided, and they took him in, wanting to help him. And they started raising him by feeding him in full view. You know, the eagles looking up saw a human putting food in his mouth. And that's one of the things that people in our business don't do. We raise eagles with minimum human contact. We don't want them to know where their food's coming from because they easily, at that age of 5 weeks of age, they can imprint very easily for life. And that's what happened to Challenger. He thought he was a person in a very short period of time while he was being fed and cared for by the people who had good intentions of helping him. So he was released into the wild twice, and three times that we know of, he landed near people and begged for food. And the third time was when he landed in outside Nashville, on a shore of a lake outside Nashville. He actually landed next to a person. The person in Challenger was walking up to this person begging for food. He was very hungry. And the guy picked up a stick immediately. It was his reaction, like he felt he was being attacked. Another man was standing nearby and saw what was happening, and he shouted out, "Stop, that's a bald eagle," you know, and of course that was Challenger's guardian angel that day.
Mm.
That's the way we look at it anyways. And he was turned into state agencies, and there was a debate for a while whether he'd go back to Alabama where he originated or whether he'd stay in Tennessee and be cared for by the American Eagle Foundation. Eventually the state agencies agreed and the federal agencies agreed that the American Eagle Foundation should take Challenger and make him into an educational ambassador, which he has since become one of the most well-known animals in the world. They're from the most well-known bald eagle in the world, and because of his educational outreach is very extensive. He sees millions of people, you know, every year at his appearances at various sporting events, various charity events, various schools and veterans' homes and VA hospitals, and we travel far and wide, and we do a lot of variety of appearances with them, but the whole purpose is to educate the public about the need to continue protecting the bald eagle for the future, and to give people just an up-close look at a very majestic animal, bird, that just can't be inspired. I mean, you can't prevent being inspired when you look at them. You know?
Right.
When you see them fly in a stadium during the Star Spangled Banner, you're just bound to get goosebumps. I don't care how many times you've heard the anthem. When you see Challenger fly, you get something that you never got before.
With that in mind, Al, I mean, there are light bulb moments and then there are light bulb moments. I mean, tell me about the one that prompted you to decide Okay, here's this eagle that can't be returned to the wild. Again, people, well-meaning people hand-fed him and Challenger imprinted. But how did you go from there to think, hey, what if I train this eagle to soar around a stadium during the singing of the national anthem? I mean, it just seems like, now, of course, you've done it for years and years, and people have seen it on TV or on video or whatever. But, I mean, at the moment when you were first conceiving it, I mean, that must have been just a very interesting, inspirational moment. Can you talk a little bit about how that idea hit you?
Yeah. Well, it was an inspirational moment for me. But let me first say that there are organizations across the country at zoos and other places that have free flight birds of prey shows where they fly hawks
sure.
and things in their show. And all these birds are what we call non-releasable. They're birds that can't survive in the wild. They're not being trapped in captivity against their will because they can survive in the wild. They can't. They've already been determined to be non-releasable by the government and the government agencies that oversee that. And so Challenger was one of those birds that had been determined that he could not survive in the wild. So he was bound into captivity. That was going to be his destiny, you know, whether yeah. we just put him in a cage and fed him every day or whether we took him out and share him with the public as an educational bird. But because he was a human imprint already by the experience he had after being blown out of a nest, that made him a perfect bird to take out to the general public and let the people see in schools and state parks, sporting events and, you know, charity fundraisers and different things across the country that we participate in. And he's a tremendous ambassador for a species. If you can reach people by inspiring them, that's the best way. You know, stays with them. It stays with them. And
absolutely.
When you see him flying during the Star Spangled Banner into a stadium during the Star Spangled Banner, that I tell this to people all the time. The crowd rises. The crowd all starts cheering as soon as they see him coming in. And they all look at each other with a smile on their face and excitement in their heart, and they're looking at Democrats, Republicans, Independents, and they're all feeling the same thing at that moment, that magic moment when he comes in and inspires them all. And so it doesn't matter what political persuasion or religious persuasion, Challenger has a way of reaching your heart and inspiring you to love your national bird.
Well, and I didn't, by all means, and I didn't want to give short shrift, didn't mean to, at least to other people and organizations that do same kind of free flight things. I guess I was more struck by when you did it, you were still, again, this kind of passionate guy who was largely self-taught and like, okay, I'm going to mm-hmm. care for eagles and do this. And then the next thing you know, you're saying, because I don't know you if you'd had too much experience training
yeah.
an eagle in that kind of thing before you said, okay, Challenger, maybe that's what his destiny is or whatever. So
well, when I founded the Eagle Foundation, I literally had no experience with birds of prey. Obviously, had other animals in my life that I've cared for from a child.
Sure. You know?
But I had no experience, and I had no experience doing fundraising or marketing or anything yeah. else that relates to a foundation. I had to learn these things by reading, by studying,
yeah.
by making contact with people who knew more than I did and to have them share their experience and their knowledge with me. And that's how you build something. You
sure.
know, you have to have some guidance. You know, Bob Hatcher was one of those that I had tremendous guidance from a conservation standpoint. He wasn't necessarily a guy that flew birds, but I went and reached out to bird shows around the country, and I learned what they were doing, and I went to conferences. You know,
yeah.
just various things you can do to kind of build up your knowledge and your experience. So, yeah, so when I first when we first got Challenger, I knew that nobody had ever flown a bald eagle into a stadium ever before. And Challenger just seemed to be that perfect bird, physically perfect, and already imprinted on people because of what he experienced in the wild.
Yeah,
and it was just a God thing. It was a God moment. Like, you know, what if you could train this eagle to fly during the Star Spangled Banner? And that's what we tried. And we were the first. He's the first eagle in U.S. history trained to free fly in a stadium during the Star Spangled Banner.
Yeah, well, that's I guess what I meant by the light bulb moment is like, oh my God, what talk about taking what some people already do with other birds and free fly things and upping it tremendously in terms of
yeah.
the challenges and the impact. And like you say, to a stadium full of people, yeah, it's mm-hmm. just so powerful. But we're sort of in our last moment or two here,
and we don't take that lightly either. When we go to make an appearance like that, a free fly, whether it's the World Series or whether it's the a Pro Bowl All-Star game or whether it's an NFL regular season game, whatever.
Yeah.
You know, we go in the day before, we rehearse him. We rehearse him before they open the gates on game day. You know, we carefully study every potential hazard. You know, like we make sure all the cabling's in the right position, that his release point is the perfect place, and where we catch him's the perfect place. All those things have to be considered, you know, when you free fly an animal like Challenger into a big forum like that, you know, where there's 50,000 people cheering and a lot of activities going on. We just don't show up and say, "Come on, go up there."
Yeah, good luck. Yeah, I'll be over here with my glove.
It's all very carefully choreographed with everything, with the fireworks, everything.
Yeah.
Because it has to go off perfectly.
Sure.
And so it's not just a whimsical thing, you know, it's an art, you know.
Right.
And
there's four or five people that typically travel with Challenger for those.
That's right.
Right?
They have a team of five people, usually for outdoor, four people for indoor. And it's, you know, they each have a job to do, not only in caring for Challenger on the road, you know, but in exercising him on the road. But all the, when we show at a stadium, everybody has a job to do, you know, it's a specific job so that it goes just like clockwork. You know.
Right. Well, so Al, we're at the end of our time. One thing I forgot to mention when people, and including our caller, were talking about the shootings and poaching and things, but I heard from, once I announced that I was doing this interview with you a day or two ago, I heard from someone who used to live in the area and now lives in Oklahoma, and it sent me a story or two and a video about a bald eagle, I believe, that was shot there just like out of a tree. And I don't know how often something like that happens now, but it was rightly so kind of a huge story in that area, and I hope uncommon.
There's still people who poach eagles and different things, and they get caught every now and then.
Yeah,
and punished. And there's there was a young kid in Texas that shot one thing. He had been taught properly, or if he had been, he just knew it wasn't just right because he shouldn't. It happens from time to time. We still experience it. People who, again, haven't been taught properly or who don't care. And, we have people with various types of psychological disorders. And that still, remains true with people who injure and kill animals.
Well, I'm going to try to take this on a little more up note. I'm going to read a couple of the emails that came in during the course of our conversation. One says, "Hi, this is to the gentleman caring for eagles. I think it's Al. Thank you for everything that you do for these magnificent birds of prey. This can't help but be good for all wildlife. I lived in Tennessee out in the sticks, and the wildlife was just awesome. I learned a lot from the animals, but my degree was in plants. Go figure, and thank you for talking animals." So that's one. And then one more I'll try to read before we say goodbye. "This is a fascinating topic. I never knew how threatened the eagles and birds of prey are until today. Thank you for explaining it and for your good work." So I think that's a great note to leave it on. Again, the website, by the way, for the American Eagle Foundation is simply eagles.org, and it's got all kinds of information and pictures, and of course you can see the nest cams from there, and it's just full of information, images, and great stuff. So it's eagles.org. And again, this has been Al Cicere, the founder of the American Eagle Foundation. Thank you so much for joining us today on Talking Animals, Al.
Happy to be here, and you've done a great job doing the interview and asking some really good and pertinent questions. I really enjoyed spending time with you.
Oh, well, thank you very much. That's very kind. All right, good luck, and give my best to Challenger.
All right, God bless.
All right, thank you. In a few moments, I'll speak with Don Goldstein about what's next in the process of seeking to pass Proposition 67 in Greyhound Racing, and how you could attend a hearing in St. Petersburg next Tuesday and make a big difference in that effort. Right now, it's time to step into the Comedy Corner with a piece I might connect nicely to our conversation with Al and about Challenger. Sure, we'll have to substitute a falcon for an eagle, but this is Andy Ritchie with a piece called Balthazar in today's Comedy Corner on Talking Animals.
This is funny, though. Somebody in my neighborhood a couple weeks ago posted a sign on a telephone pole for a lost falcon. Like the bird. They're like, "We lost our falcon, help us." I'm like, "I can't. I'm not the Beastmaster. I can't summon wildlife from the skies." Like, if you lose your dog and you post a sign, like, yeah, there's a chance you get your dog back. But if you lose your falcon, it's gone, dude. Forever. Because it can fly and it hates you. It's not going to be hanging out in the woods one day like, "God damn it, I really miss that hood. Nobody puts a hood on me out here that makes me think I'm asleep. That sucks." It's like, these people are never going to get their falcon back. I was like, well, maybe they'll get their falcon back. Because they're very smart. When they made the poster, they put a picture of the falcon on the poster. Yeah, which is very helpful if you're the one looking for it, right? Because that way you don't show up at their doorstep with the wrong falcon. I think we've all been there before. It's incredibly embarrassing. For all three parties involved, really. Falcon's just like, oh, this is not my house. I don't know why the falcon's Jewish in this joke, but it's a Yiddish falcon. And then underneath the picture, they put the falcon's name. Balthazar. And there was a $300 reward for him, too. I guess they're really expensive. So I'm like, whatever. I got nothing better to do this afternoon. I start walking up and on my block like, Balthazar! Balthazar! People are giving me spare change. Poor kid's touched in the head.
That was the late, great Andy Ritchie with a piece called Balthazar, taken from his album, King Ding-a-ling. Okay, on to Don Goldstein to fill us in on the next chapter of the saga that could result in the end of greyhound racing in Florida. So this is Don Goldstein back on Talking Animals. Good morning, Don.
Good morning, Duncan. How are you today?
Great. Thanks for joining us again on Talking Animals. And for those who may not have heard our previous conversation, especially with this kind of focus, let's start with maybe a quick overview of what Prop 67 is, what it seeks to do, and where we are so far.
Certainly. Every 20 years in Florida, they have a Constitution Revision Commission, and this is one of those years. And the commission has the right to bring forth propositions, proposed amendments. There were originally 109 proposed. There are 37 remaining. Proposal 67 was originally put forward by Commissioner Tom Lee, a state senator from the Brandon-Sefner area. It was also co-sponsored by ex-Senate President Don Gates and another commissioner by the name of Brecht Hutchin. Those three gentlemen have been fighting hard for this. What Prop 67 would do is would phase out greyhound racing by December 31st of 2019 in the state of Florida.
So there's been some steps in that process so far. What's the pivotal next step that involves these Constitutional Revision Committee hearings?
Okay, each of the 109 went through one or two or more committees, and those that survived the committee process are down to, like I said, 37.
Yeah.
This month, they have been doing public hearings, which are basically listening sessions for the commissioners to get public input on those remaining 37 proposed amendments. They've had five of those so far. The last one was Monday down in Cape Coral, which I attended. And then the last one is next Tuesday, March 13th, and it's at the University of South Florida, St. Petersburg campus in St. Pete.
I'd like to think that many people listening to this, either live at the moment or on the archive or later as a podcast, live either in St. Pete or close enough to get to that hearing, especially if they know the importance of turning up and speaking out. So maybe you could talk a little bit about the counterpart meeting that you went to earlier this week on Monday and sort of describe at least briefly what would be expected, therefore, to happen on Tuesday. And again, how people who care about the greyhound racing issue and basically care about ending greyhound racing in Florida, what they could do next Tuesday specifically.
Sure. If you want to speak, you'll need to submit a speaker's card, which are available online at www.flcrc.gov. That's the Constitution Revision Commission's website. You can download the card and print it out and then just fill it out and hand it in to the citizen service desk at the front door of the hearing. They also have them available there. Just take a pen to fill it out. The speakers are asked to come up. You have 2 minutes, and they time it. They've got a big clock up on a screen right behind the commissioners, and they will cut you off in mid-word at 2 minutes, so plan on that. But they call you up in the order in which the cards are submitted. So they open up the citizen service desk at noon. The hearing itself goes from 1 o'clock to 7 o'clock. There was about 500 speakers, I believe, at the Cape Coral. About 45 of which spoke on the Greyhound issue. We would like to see a lot more people speaking on the Greyhound issue at St. Petersburg, particularly since there's a track so close. So we urge you to show up, fill out a speaker's card, plan on speaking for no more than 2 minutes, and let the commissioners know that you support ending Greyhound racing in the state of Florida.
So a couple things to follow up on that, Don. So I take it that your place in line, as it were, only begins when you're physically there and turn in your speaker's card. There's no way to submit, even though you get the card online, you can't submit anything or get rolling prior to being physically there at the hearing.
That's correct.
Yeah.
There is no way to do that. They limit it to the in-person.
Yeah, okay. So the next thing is, if I'm not mistaken, if someone felt strongly about this and could figure out the time, I mean, that's a pretty decent window. Maybe you could take your lunch or just do something, you know, and just scoot over there and hope. But if you are just like too nervous even for the 2 minutes to be public speaking, is there also a provision, I think, that you could write out a card, either the same speaker's card or something counterpart, and express your view and submit that without speaking in front of the mic?
No, there really isn't.
Okay.
But what you can do is on that website, flcrc.gov, there's an email address for each of the 37 commissioners, and you certainly can submit your viewpoint to each of those 37 commissioners. And I assure you, I've talked to them, they do read them.
That's an alternative if you can't make it over there at all, but if you can, it seems like it's hugely important just to power numbers thing and also just to take that 2 minutes and speak to why Greyhound racing should be ended.
Yes, absolutely. All of the commissioners will not be there. At the Cape Coral, it varied between 10 and 12. But they're all videotaped, they're all transcribed, and the commissioners, I know they're reading this stuff. They need this input. They want this input, this public input.
Okay. And one last thing. I saw at least one email, maybe more. Is there something to wearing a red shirt or blouse if you are going to speak on this issue?
Several of the advocacy groups here are trying to get that done. The other thing that people do is kind of interesting. They either bring colored plates, red or green, or other large pieces of paper that they can hold up, a green one if you are in support of the current speaker, or a red one if you do not like the issue, the side that the current speaker is taking.
Wow.
You can do that on any number of issues. There were a lot of green and red cards being held up at Cape Coral.
Well, I like it. I like the color coding here of one kind or another. So Don, we're out of time, I'm afraid. But again, I think we covered a lot of important ground here. And again, so that's next Tuesday, March 13th, University of South Florida, St. Pete campus between noon. Get there at noon, I guess, but the hearing begins and runs from 1 to 7 p.m., correct?
You got it. That's
okay.
Perfect.
Thank you, and we'll keep us posted on all this as we move along and hopefully get this thing done. So thanks again, Don.
As always, thank you for your support, Duncan.
You bet.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. All right, so we have just about reached the tail end of Talking Animals on WMNF Tampa. Coming up at 11, it's Rob Lori with Radioactivity. Then Midpoint with Nola Lay in the noon hour. Then at 1 p.m., John Gilmore presides over executive session. Then the music kicks back in at 2 p.m. with Scott Elliott and the All Souls edition of It's the Music. It's WMNF Tampa. We'll see you next Wednesday at 10 a.m. on Talking Animals. Thanks.